All right, don't put that down. We're going to mark the quiz now. Okay, here we go. Keep track of how many you get right. And by the way, all the answers were in what we just read. How many wise men or magi came to see Jesus? 3, 2, 6. The answer is? We're not told. Well done. Let's see if we get that. There we go. Yeah, we're not told. We don't know how many. Why do we say 3 wise men? Well, that's the number there was. Yeah, or how many, that's how the Christmas carol goes. It's hard enough to find 3 wise men at Christmas. No, I think it's because they gave 3 presents. But like the gold was expensive, you could have had 2 guys kick in for the gold. There might have been 4 or 5 or whatever. So the answer is D, they gave Jesus 3 presents. Let's see, number 3. This isn't working too well. How long have they been travelling? Now this one's tricky. 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months. And the answer is up to 2 years. We'll get it eventually. You see the picture here. You've got the wise men arriving and Jesus in the manger, in the little, in the feed trough, all wrapped up, etc. Nice picture, but it's not what Matthew 2 tells us. We'll see that. Jesus was probably a toddler by the time that they finally arrived. Okay, number 4. How old was Jesus when the wise men found him? Nice picture, Jesus in the manger there, kind of glowing in the dark as well. But the answer is he could have been anything up to 2 years old. And we'll see why in just a moment. Okay, number 5, who was the king at the time of Jesus' birth? The answer is Herod the Great. And I'd say he almost certainly made up his own name because I don't think anyone around him thought he was a great man. Number 6, where did Jesus spend the first 3 to 10, maybe 3 to 12 years of his life? Answer, Egypt. And why did they go to Egypt? Well, we'll see in a moment why Egypt in particular. And then 7, Rachel's tomb is in Israel today. I've been to Jerusalem, I haven't been to Bethlehem, but on the outskirts of Bethlehem, Rachel's tomb is there. You can visit via Google if you want. It's pretty heavily guarded as well. And then, number 8, at the news of the Messiah's birth, what did the wise men do? What did King Herod do? What did the general population do? I missed it, mate. I'm sorry. We'll see over the next 20 or so minutes, eh? Okay. Now, what I'd like to do, we'll see if the technology will work, because this clicker is not working. Okay, well, let's see. I want to show you a clip of a movie that was on last Christmas.
This holiday season, witness the story of the first Christmas through a whole new set of eyes.
It's the wise men.
Hide quickly.
The other way.
The other left.
Deborah, are you okay? How many hooves am I holding up?
From the studio that brought you Miracles from Heaven and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Meet the unlikely heroes behind the greatest story ever told.
Herod is up to something.
Marion needs help. We need to save her. You're in danger. You need to listen to what I'm about to say extremely carefully.
Do you want a belly rub?
Boom.
If you want to get to my friends, you're going to have to get past me first. What is that?
What's what? I wasn't supposed to look, was I?
Donkey kick!
Dave.
I'm gonna go find someone to poop on. Nope, too big!
Ruth.
Almost down. One more chasm.
Uh-oh.
Well, didn't exactly stick the landing, but that was good.
Dave!
I'm under you and in a lot of pain.
And Deborah, Cyrus, and Felix.
The new king's in danger.
Run for your life!
Get out of the way!
Here's a little well-placed distraction.
The star.
Wait a second, are they eating chicken? Ladies, run!
If you missed it at the box office, I'm sure you can get it on iTunes. Talking animals, saving the day, great fun. Just like Madagascar. See Madagascar? That's fun. I like to move it. And Kung Fu Panda, where the panda finds out he's actually adopted from the parents who are actually geese and all that. That's great fun. All right, grandkids, I love those movies. This one, The Star, I know I'm old and grumpy. I am, but doesn't mean I'm wrong. It just doesn't quite fit. It's so different to Matthew chapter 2. Because Matthew chapter 2, look, I don't want to spoil things. Madagascar and Kung Fu Panda, they're not true. They're made up. And Matthew's telling us something very different in Matthew chapter 2. It's real and it's gritty. In fact, there's a couple of pictures that I've seen that kind of speak more about Matthew chapter 2. The Slaughter of the Innocents by Leon Conner in 1824. What does that say? It talks about terror. You just have a Google that picture and you see it up close, and he's really got the eyes of the mum as she holds her baby so close in fear of the soldiers who've just arrived. Or the other one that I like, Luke Merson, 1879, and The Flight to Egypt. Now, I don't think Jesus glowed in the dark like here, but you see what it says, mum, Joseph, exhaustion and running for their lives. That's Matthew chapter 2. Now, if you were here last week, what did we say? There's two of the Gospels, Luke and Matthew, tell us the story of Jesus' birth. Luke tells it through the eyes of Mary, and Matthew mostly tells it through the eyes of Joseph. Luke gives you the big positive thing, you know, joy to the world, and the angels turn up and they're singing and it's peace on earth and blessing to those on whom God's favour rests, etc. And that's absolutely true. What Matthew shows you is Jesus is born as the king, but from the very beginning there's a dark side to Christmas. It's real, it's painful in so many ways. Now the question is, did it happen? Did these events happen in history? So how about you have a walk with me for a few minutes? Let's read Matthew chapter 2 and I'll show you each of the historical touch points where we can check this out against other histories, etc. So you might like to follow. You can follow in the Bible. It'd be the second page of the New Testament or in your program. Let's read it. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." Okay, let's say, you see the word magi there. You can translate it, I guess, as wise men. That would be fair enough. It's the word used about astrologers, etc., people who told the future from the stars, used in the Persian Empire or the Babylonian empires. And these guys turn up. We'll say a little more about the star in just a moment. There's a tradition that goes right back to Tertullian, one of the church fathers in 225, that they're three kings. You've got the song, we three kings of Orient, and their names, I can never remember, Balthazar or something. Anyway, great story, nice song, but the New Testament doesn't actually say that. Why do we say three? Oh, I guess they gave three presents, okay. Now, why have they come? The Old Testament, in the book of Numbers, written by Moses, is a promise about a great king being born in Israel, and that the marker of the great king being born would be a star. I'll show you. Here we go. Numbers chapter 24 says this: "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob." Another way of talking about the Jews or Israel. "A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel." Now, with the translation of the Old Testament into Greek, the Septuagint, as it was called, this particular prophecy was well known enough around the ancient world for Tacitus and Suetonius, both Roman historians, not Christian, Roman historians, to have talked about it. It was widely known. And these magi have seen something special in the stars and they've turned up. Now, why did they come? Well, Paul Barnett has written a number, but these two in particular I like. He lectured in history at Macquarie University, and so he wrote Bethlehem to Patmos. Bethlehem's the first town mentioned in the New Testament, or the beginning of the New Testament, and Patmos is the last island mentioned in the New Testament. Brilliant little book. You can still get it if you look on the web. And the other one is the New Testament History. If you're interested to understand the history about the New Testament, I'd start with Is the New Testament History. Simple, clear, it's brilliant. He talks about why it is that they've turned up. So it's not just random. They're convinced that there's a great king being born. So Paul Barnett says this. It may be assumed that they, the Magi, did not know the world ruler was to be of obscure background. In other words, when they turn up looking for the Messiah, they don't go to a shed in Bethlehem. They went to Jerusalem. They went to the capital. They went to the palace, which makes sense. Their visit was probably primarily a diplomatic gesture and their gifts designed to create a favourable impression upon the court of the new monarch. So they turn up with gifts and everything ready to kind of, you know, a goodwill gesture to the one who's been born king. But how did they turn up? Is there any kind of scientific evidence that points towards the idea of the star? Well, I did some research. Paul Barnett pointed me this way. Time magazine, way back, some of you will think this is an ancient document, 1976. It's the year I finished school. Probably about the time you finished school too, Bruce, is that right? Yep. Okay, the 70s, beautiful. Let me read to you from Time magazine in 1976. Time magazine is anything but certainly not a Christian publication, but they published this thing in December of 76 called Science and the Holy Light. And it's an article about what happened in the sky around the time of the birth of Jesus and could explain the wise men travelling. Half the article goes through and says, oh, okay, they've worked out it's not a comet, no, there's nothing in the sky then, not a supernova, no stars exploded, etc. Here's what they say. But there's one kind of celestial display that could account for Matthew's reference to the Star of Bethlehem. Studies of early calendars and historical records of events immediately preceding and following the Nativity suggest to many scholars that Jesus was probably born sometime during the fall of the year 7 BC. That year, the heavens offered a display that few who studied the stars would have failed to notice. Three times in 7 BC, there was a conjunction of the same two planets. So what are conjunctions? Conjunctions, or what seem to be close approaches of the planets in the sky, are common occurrences. They take place at periodic intervals as the planets orbit the sun at differing angular velocities. In May of 7 BC, Jupiter, which astrologers of the period considered both a royal star and a lucky one, first moved close in the sky to Saturn, which was believed to influence the destiny of the Jews. Even more significant, this conjunction occurred in the constellation of Pisces, where celestial events traditionally foretold incidents of great importance to Israel. In September of that year, Jupiter again closed in on Saturn. Some astronomers and biblical scholars speculate that the first conjunction may have been the signal that started the Magi on their long trek to Israel, the second, the beacon that guided them on their journey. The reasoning seems to accommodate the timetable of the Christmas story, for in December, the two planets came together for a third time as if on cue to show the final way to Bethlehem. If you do a little Google search, you can find that idea about the conjunction of those two planets to make what looked like a new star goes right back to Johann Kepler, as a German astronomer in 1606. So it's been around for quite a while. So the star will get them, okay, the new king born of the Jews, will get them to Judea and get them into Jerusalem to look. So what do? Well, they go to the palace and they ask King Herod. Now have a look at verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. I bet they were, because when King Herod got stirred up, people tended to lose their heads. We'll go back. King Herod, Herod the Great. He was a puppet king. There's actually about seven different Herods mentioned in the New Testament, the whole several generations. King Herod was a puppet king. He ruled Judea, as you see, from 37 BC to 4 BC when he died. His father Antipater had helped the Romans conquer Judea and Galilee, etc., in 63 BC, and he'd managed somehow to get his son onto the throne. He ruled for 33 years. Herod was a nasty piece of work. I'll come back to that in a second. But you notice he died in 4 BC, and Matthew's just said Jesus is born while Herod is king. So how do we make sense of that? You'd expect Jesus to be born in 0 BC, okay, or 0 AD. Well, Paul Barnett explains. Here we go. Since Herod died in 4 BC, Jesus must have been born in 7 or 6 BC to satisfy the detail of the search for the boys 2 years old. We'll come to that in a moment. Why is our Anno Domini calendar incorrect? It's because the 6th century monk Dionysius, when reforming the Roman calendar along Christian lines to pivot around the birth of Jesus, miscalculated the date of the death of Herod relative to the founding of Rome, the previous starting point for Western calendars. So, as they say, missed it by that much. Jesus probably born 6, 7 BC. Herod the Great, well, he was a great builder. There's a huge long list that Josephus gives of the different buildings and things he'd built, even fortified towns or forts, Machaerus and Masada and others. But he was a nasty piece of work. Here's Paul Barnett quoting. Paul Barnett quotes Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, who says this: "By the time his reign came to an end, Herod was a depressed old man of 70, plagued with illness and incessant disputes within his large family. He had in all 10 wives and 19 children." I wonder how ever you could have family problems with a family like that, but anyway. Herod's suspicion bordered on paranoia. He killed his own wife and at a later date her adult sons, Alexander and Aristobulus. Augustus, the emperor, made the grim joke that it was safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. Herod set out to be a very good Jewish man with the food laws. Josephus commented that Herod had an evil nature, relentless in punishment and unsparing in action against the objects of his hatred. How bad was he? Well, there's one story in Josephus that kind of sums it up. He knew people hated him. So when he was on his deathbed, he had the leading citizens of Judea arrested and held in prison or kind of concentration camp, and he gave this order. He said, "The moment I expire, have them, the leading citizens, massacred. And so shall all Judea and every household weep for me, whether they will or no." As far as I understand, the order was never carried out, but that's the kind of man who's in charge when the Magi turn up and say, "Where's the new king who's been born?" Well, what happened? See verse 4. "When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them," and Herod asked them, "where the Messiah was to be born." Now, Messiah is a way of talking about the great king promised in the Old Testament. So for 2,000 years, the Old Testament had been promising that God would send the great king who would rescue his people, who would deal with sin, who would set up God's kingdom. The Hebrew way of saying it, the Messiah. The Greek way to say it, Christos or Christ. In English, the anointed one, the special one. Okay. And now they answer. See verse 5. "In Bethlehem in Judea," the religious leaders replied, "for this is what the prophet has written," verse 6, "but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Why is it that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem? It's only a little village. Well, you see, it's about 10, 11 kilometres, something like that, from Jerusalem, 2 hours' walk. Why there? Well, King David, who was the greatest king of ancient Israel, had been born in Bethlehem 1,000 years before that, and the Old Testament, Micah promised that the capital M Messiah would also come from that same little town or little village. Okay, so Herod hears this, the religious leaders tell him this, the chief priests, teachers of the law, and then verse 7, "Then Herod called the Magi secretly." Notice he wants to keep a lid on this. There's rumours about it, but he wants to keep a lid on it. "Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared." He doesn't mean did it appear at 6 p.m. or 8 p.m. He meant how many months ago. Why? How old is this child? How old is this star? Verse 8, "He sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him.'" We'll see why he wants to find him in a moment. Verse 9, "After they heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed." I don't think it means like a Christmas card that the star's sitting directly over one little house. I think the star took them in the direction of Bethlehem, a little village. You ask around and you find it. Verse 11, "On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him." Do you notice, though, it's not like Luke. It doesn't say the child's in a manger. Jesus is probably a toddler by now, a year, between a year and 2 years old. So what happens then? Middle of verse 11, then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense and myrrh. Okay, gold we understand. Frankincense is a glittering, smelling gum made from the bark of trees, and it's got a whole lot of medicinal properties. There's a whole long list of things it was supposed to cure. It's very valuable. And myrrh was a spice or perfume that came from Arabia. So they bring presents, they offer, they bow down or they prostrate themselves before him. Verse 12, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their own country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt and stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So God keeps the little family safe by speaking to Joseph in a dream. Why Egypt was an excellent place to escape. Josephus, the historian, tells us that were maybe a million Jewish people living around the delta in the northern part of Egypt in the first century. So you could just go there, a little family of refugees, asylum seekers, and you can just go there and kind of just blend in, disappear into the crowd. Joseph's a carpenter, he could get work. In fact, Kathy and I were on holidays in Egypt 2006, I think. Yep. And we had 3 weeks there. It was great. And we had a tour guide who took us and showed us the little flat that Joseph and Mary and Jesus lived in while they were in Egypt. We said, uh-huh, sure. It was right beside a souvenir shop as well. Who would have thought? Anyway, they need the tourism. That's fine. Okay, see verse 14. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Okay, look at that last little bit. Very important in understanding what Matthew's showing. Out of Egypt I called my son. That's a quote from the prophecy of Hosea, about 8th century BC in the Old Testament, Hosea 11 verse 1. What's Matthew showing us? In the Old Testament, the nation of Israel are referred to, or God calls the nation of Israel his son. So when God creates the nation and he takes them out of slavery in Egypt, he says to Pharaoh, Israel's my son, let my son go. So Israel becomes known as God's son, but as time goes on, they fail, they're corrupt, they worship other gods, everything falls apart. Now what Matthew's showing us is this, when Hosea talked about God calling his son out of Egypt, really what he's talking about is how that will be fulfilled, is God bringing Jesus, his true son, out of Egypt. So Jesus comes, what Matthew's trying to show us is Jesus comes to reform the people of God. Jesus is the true son of God and he's going to actually remake the people of God. And the way Matthew shows us that is he shows a whole lot of parallels between when Moses does this in the Exodus, how the people of God got started, and then how Jesus reforms, if you like, or reforms the people of God. If you're used to reading the Bible, I get it. If you're not used to the Bible, that's fine. This is only going to take 2 minutes, and then we're on to straightforward stuff again, okay? You with me? Okay, I've got four, five nodded. Okay, excellent. All right, here we go. Here's what I'm going to show you. I'll show you what Moses did, and then I'll show you how Matthew shows us what Jesus does and why the beginning of Matthew is written the way it is. Okay, when God uses Moses to create the nation, Israel, the people of God, how does he do it? Well, there's a special baby born. That would be Moses, kept safe for 3 months, and then you've got the little boat on the Nile and Pharaoh's daughter, etc. The threat of a tyrant, Pharaoh, the tyrant who would even kill the boys because of his paranoia. They're brought out of Egypt. Right? Out of Egypt I've called my son. 40 years in the desert, learning dependency on God and humility, etc. There's 12 tribes, the 12 patriarchs and the 12 tribes that are foundation of the people of God. They go to Mount Sinai after God's rescued them and God gives them the Ten Commandments, tells them how they're to live as the people of God, and they enter the Promised Land by crossing the Jordan River. Okay, that's the Old Testament with Moses. With Jesus, There's a special baby born in Bethlehem. There's a threat from a tyrant, Herod the Great, a tyrant who even kills baby boys because of his paranoia. They're brought, or Jesus, as the Son of God, is brought out of Egypt. Jesus has 40 days in the desert. We'd come to that if we kept reading. He chooses 12 disciples who are the foundation of the people of God. In chapter 5, anyone remember what Jesus does? He gives the sermon on the mount, up onto the mountain, tells his people how to live as the people of God, and Jesus begins his ministry as an adult by being baptized in the Jordan River. He's restarting the people of God. There's all these kind of Old Testament echoes there. He's starting as the true Israel. Okay, if you got that, think more about it. If you didn't, that's fine. Look at verse 16. When Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he learned from the Magi. I think probably Herod built in a margin for error. Jesus was probably a bit over a year or maybe 18 months old. Herod says everybody under two. The scholars tell me it was perhaps maybe 20 little boys, given the population, they guess, at that time. But what a tragedy. You can see why, you know, the movie The Star, the talking animals, or it just doesn't fit. You've got a young couple, helpless baby, dictators, murder, refugees. Things haven't changed much in our world. And heartache. See verse 17. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. See in the middle of the verse, Rachel. Way back in Genesis chapter 35, Rachel, who's one of the wives of, or Jacob has two sisters who are wives, Leah and Rachel. Jacob later has his name changed to Israel. He's kind of, if you like, the patriarch of the nation. Rachel is one of the matriarchs, I suppose. She becomes known as the mother of Israel. And she dies in childbirth, giving birth to Jacob, to their youngest son, Benjamin. And he's brokenhearted about it. He builds a tomb for her near Bethlehem. Now, that's about 1700 BC. Rachel's tomb begins, and it's still there today. About 600 BC, the Babylonians invade Jerusalem and they conquer it and they assemble a whole lot of the people that they're going to deport or execute, etc. One of the assembly stations is right near Bethlehem in Ramah. And Jeremiah says it's as if Rachel weeps for her children, the nation. And Matthew says now Rachel's tomb's right there. She would weep too as Herod has killed some of her babies. Rachel's tomb, right there today. Matthew continues, see verse 19, it's on the screen or in your program. After Herod died, so he's in Egypt for a few years. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, way up in the north, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets that he would be called a Nazarene. I'll come back to that idea of Nazarene in just a moment. Archelaus, you may never have thought much about him, but here's what history tells us. After the death of Herod the Great in 4 BC, his kingdom was divided up. One of his daughters was given a city to rule, and then the main parts of his kingdom was divided between three of his sons. The gold in the north, Herod Philip ruled there, and then the green, Galilee and Perea on either side of the Jordan, was Herod Antipas. Now, he's the one who later on in Mark chapter 6 arrests John the Baptist and has John the Baptist executed. Okay, and then Archelaus, one of the other sons, ruled Judea, the red part on the map. Unfortunately, the apple didn't fall too far from the tree, and Archelaus was cruel, stupid, tyrannical. He he did some things that resulted, well, once he sent the army into the city in Jerusalem and it ended up with 3,000 civilians killed. In fact, he did such a messy job that in 6 AD, the Romans kicked him out. The Romans threw him off the throne and they put in an administrator or a governor. So the Romans, by direct rule, ruled Judea. Now, there were, I know of 5 of the governors, okay? So when they started in 6 AD, there was Coponius, then there was Ambibulus, and then Rufus, and then Gratus, and that gets us up to 26 AD. And you know what? You know who the 5th governor of Judea is, or was. He ruled from 27 AD to 36 AD. Anyone? Pontius Pilate. Well done. Right. Why have we heard of Pontius Pilate? Well, when the baby grew up, he was on trial before Pontius Pilate. Do you see how it fits together? My point is, it really happened. It really happened. And what we know about the rest of history from Josephus and other historians and so on, and you put it together, this really happened. And look, I'm all for Christmas stuff. A couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, Kathy called me the Grinch because I was cranky about Christmas. And I decided, right, I'm going to be Mr. Christmas. You should see the Christmas tree we've got. I've got 3 different lots of lights on the Christmas tree at the moment and 2 lots of solar-powered lights around our veranda. It is awesome. All right? I've already wrapped up about 4 or 5 presents and Mr. Christmas. And so all the elves and reindeer and snow, it's great. I'm all for it, as long as we don't lose the main... Why does it matter so much? Because Matthew's showing us this really happened, and this baby who was born there grew up, right? and taught us about God. In fact, more than that, showed us what it was like, showed us God himself, and said that we live in a broken world where we've walked away from God and that we desperately need forgiveness, and he is the only one that can give us forgiveness, and the only way for that to happen was for him to die in our place and to rise again. And Matthew will go on to show that our eternity hangs on how we respond to what this baby did when he grew up. And so it matters. Now, let's go back to that quiz. Did anybody get 7 out of 7 for the quiz? Come on, anyone? Anyone? Just kind of nod then. But Kathy did, yeah. Okay, good. Well, the preacher's wife should, and she was here this morning, so okay. All right, very good. The last question, though. At the news of the Messiah's birth, what did... Well, the wise men, what did they do? Well, they didn't have a lot of information. Somehow they worked out that they thought from the stars that this had happened. They travel 1,000 kilometres on camels. They bring their presents... They didn't have a lot of information, but they did their best with it. King Herod, it's hard to know whether Herod actually believed the prophecy or not. What he was worried about is other people believing it. And he worried about it enough to send his soldiers to have a village full of little boys murdered. He took it very seriously. And the general population, what did they do? Well, they're disturbed in verse 3. Because Herod is disturbed, you can understand that, and there's rumours have spread about this, and the Magi turn up, etc. But what did the general population do? Well, as far as we know, nothing. Why? I'll show you one of my favourite paintings. This is a painting by Pieter Bruegel. There you go. He's a Flemish artist. This is painted in 1566, and this is called The Numbering at Bethlehem. In Bethlehem, and so it's pretty much a standard medieval European winter scene. You've got people outside the bread shop there on the left. You've got a guy unloading a wagon. You've got kids playing snowballs and etc. Snowball fights up there in the top. Why would it be called The Numbering at Bethlehem? Well, if you look carefully in the front, it's these two people that we need to look at. Let's just see. If only we could zoom in a bit closer. Ready? How good's that? Oh, I did that myself. Seriously. Can you? Okay. All right. You guys take that for granted. I'm going to go back and show you again. Okay. Ready? Numbering at Bethlehem, those two people, and zoop. Beautiful. Now, if you look, though, in front is a man leading a lady on a leading a woman on a donkey, right? And the man's carrying over his shoulder a saw and a block of wood. And she is on a donkey, yes, but she's all wrapped up and she could very well be pregnant. And what is Bruegel's point? And that is, in the middle of all of the activity of buying the bread and unloading the wagons and throwing the snowballs and that guy, and Mary and Joseph and the baby turned up and the baby was born and what? No one noticed. Why? They were busy. And why were they busy? It's Christmas time. Huh? Everyone's busy at Christmas, aren't they? There's so much to do. And so, and I say every year, I always think it's a pity that Jesus was born at Christmas time. Would have been better if he'd been born in like July or something, when there's not much on and it's cold and, you know, we had time to think about it. If you've never read a gospel, or if you haven't read one for a while, or if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, by the way, if you're not there yet, it's great that you're here. Jesus has arranged some public holidays soon, and so we've all got some time. It'd be really good to read a gospel. Read Matthew or Luke. They're the ones that start with Christmas. And I'll tell you, when St. Catherine and I have a bit of time off soon, we should do that too. And you read a gospel, and I'll tell you, the person of Jesus just steps off the page. And you see who he is. Let me just pull some threads together as we finish. The Nazarene thing, what does that mean? There's no direct quote in the Old Testament that says he will be called a Nazarene. The NIV's got it pretty right and said he would be the idea of that he would be called a Nazarene, meaning Nazareth was kind of nowheresville. No one important ever came from Nazareth. It was the middle of nowhere. Coming from Nazareth is like, well, I'm from Grafton, okay, up in the bush. In fact, I'm not even from Grafton. I'm from South Grafton. It's a bit like coming from South Grafton. South Grafton, it's a bit like that. So people look down on him because he'd come from Nazareth or even the region of Galilee. You've got that. People despised him and where he'd come from. That's the point. So he would be regarded as a hillbilly or a bogan. And so if you were here last week, the end of Matthew chapter 1, we meant to see the contrast of the end of Matthew chapter 1 and the end of Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 1 finishes with this magnificent thing about the promise in the Old Testament. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. And chapter 1 finishes by saying Jesus is actually God become one of us. And chapter 2 finishes by saying, yeah, and he'll be despised and mocked and looked down on. That's the point. And what's Matthew showing us? He's shown us the real world. He's shown us a world of where unplanned pregnancies were a problem, where the thought of divorce was terrible, where a long journey for a pregnant woman would exhaust her, where young couples flee from tyrants who would kill them, where you've got to go and hide as a political refugee, where death squads turn up and kill even children, where one tyrant is succeeded by another who's maybe even worse. And Jesus grows up in obscurity. It's almost certain that Jesus' legal father, Joseph, dies between when Jesus is 12 years old and when Jesus is about 30 years old. In fact, I think, this is just my little theory, the reason that Jesus works as a carpenter in Nazareth until he's 30-something is so that his siblings, his brothers, actually have grown old enough to take over the family business and care for mum and the rest of the family. And then he goes out and changes the world. And what's Matthew showing us? Well, he's showing us that, yeah, Jesus is the king, born to be king, and the nations, beyond Judaism, the nations will come to him, the three magi at the very beginning, and at the death of Jesus, it's the Roman centurion who says, surely this is the Son of God. So the nations will see, but right from the beginning, it's cost him. He suffered. He knows. You think life's tough? He knows. He lived through it. In fact, 800 years before Jesus, the prophet Isaiah, and perhaps the most famous chapter of the Old Testament, talks about what it would be when the Messiah came, when the suffering servant came, what would life be like for him? Let me read you a little bit of Isaiah 53. It says, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God and stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. In fact, yeah, he did know what it was to suffer. The book of Hebrews says, and you might look, you could read this later yourself, the book of Hebrews in chapter 4 says, if you'll trust Jesus, one of the reasons to trust him and follow him is this, that he's lived through that pain and suffering and been tested or tempted just the way that we are. He gets it. He's been there with us. He understands. Or to finish, as the Apostle Paul says, what is it that's so wonderful about this story? He says, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. He became poor so that if we will trust him, we can know forgiveness and be spiritually rich with God. And Matthew's showing us this really happened. It's gritty, it's dark, but it's very good news. Will you pray with me? Lord God, we thank you for the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, for his love in stepping into our broken world, that he lived perfectly as your true son and then died as our substitute to pay the price of forgiveness. We ask, please, that we may all come to know him and the forgiveness that he won and the new life he promises in his resurrection. And we ask these things in his name. Amen.